The following is an edited version of Divided Waters, a community discussion about how offshore wind and fishing might coexist in the age of climate change. The event was held on January 30th at District Hall in Providence. This event was produced by the Institute at Brown for Environment and Society, the Publix Radio, and our podcast, Possibly. Rhode Island is in the center of a complicated conversation about the future of our oceans. Our state has the first 5 offshore wind turbines in the country, and there are hundreds more planned nearby. But Rhode Island is also home to a vibrant fishing industry, and they're seeing their waters warming as fast as anywhere on Earth. Some say offshore wind is necessary to address climate change. Others say it's a gold rush, and they're worried fishermen and marine life will get caught up in the stampede. Can both these industries coexist? We'll hear from a panel of experts, and then we'll hear select questions from the audience. Our panelists are Dave Butel, Aquaculture Coordinator for the Coastal Resources Management Council, Lanny Dellinger, Lobsterman and Chair of the Rhode Island Fisheries Advisory Board, Ed LeBlanc, Orsted's Manager for Marine Affairs, Becca Selden, Assistant Professor of Biological Sciences at Wellesley College, and Kevin Stokesbury, Professor of Fisheries Oceanography at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. The forum is hosted by Megan Hall, host of the Possibly podcast.
So we have a lot of people on the stage, so we're not going to have everyone answer every question, but everyone is going to have a chance to talk. All right, so first let's start with a little bit of background. Dave Butel, just give us a quick snapshot of all the wind turbines in the ocean and all the ones that are planned in this area.
Okay, thank you, Megan. As you said in your introduction, right now there are 5 wind turbines in state waters south of Rhode Island. The amount of power that has been procured by New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts, and when procured means that it has been purchased, basically, is 4,214 megawatts.
And what does that mean in terms of wind farms or how many turbines are in the water?
That means somewhere between 420 and 520 wind turbines.
In an area the size of?
In southern New England, in the southern New England leased area, which is, it's bigger than Rhode Island, but not way bigger.
So, Ed LeBlanc, give us your best pitch for why we need all of these wind farms in the ocean.
Megan, first, Orsted thanks you, and I thank you for inviting us to participate in the conversation tonight. Why we need wind? Well, the wind is here. That's where the wind is. And the outer continental shelf is here, and that's where we can put towers. And this is really being driven, if you will, by public policy. Our leaders, our state and national leaders, have dictated that they want renewable energy. They want energy from renewable sources, and we're sort of filling that call, if you will, for renewable energy.
So, Lanny Dellinger, you've been fishing these waters for 40 years. What's your biggest fear about sharing the ocean with all these wind farms?
The problem that I see is a lack of science to show us that we are not going to be causing a whole bunch of harm out there. I mean, everybody knows what Narragansett Bay is. Narragansett Bay in 1987 was deemed an estuary of national significance by Congress. We also have Buzzards Bay. We have all of these different estuaries, okay, where all of these different species come to the beach to spawn every single summer. It's been going on for hundreds of years. When you're going to put 1,400 square miles of buried EMF cable, electrical cables in the bottom that interfere, and the science tells us it does have an effect on a lot of different species, we should know what we're doing before we go down that road. I don't think the vast majority of the fishing industry is not against these projects. We just want to make sure it's done properly and that we're not creating a whole other problem down the road. Almost zero baseline studies have been conducted, so we'll never really have a grasp on exactly what we did do to these species or the environment of that.
And we'll dig into some more of those details as we continue on in the panel. So let's dig into the details now. Thank you for starting that, Lanny. just so we can kind of organize our thoughts, because there's so many things to consider when we're talking about wind farms and fisheries. We're going to start with one of the major concerns about these wind farms, which is where to put them. Like, where do they go in the water? So we're going to start with tackling that issue. Dave Butel, you played a large role in the Rhode Island Ocean SAMP. It was a group of stakeholders. It was a lot of research, thinking about the future of our ocean. So when you were doing that work, you mapped out the best location for offshore wind energy. What did you have to consider when you were trying to find the best spot?
Megan, that is a little bit of an assumption. The areas offshore where the wind turbines are going to go in federal waters, while we mapped the activities that go there, we did not choose those areas. That was chosen by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, not by the state of Rhode Island as a place that would be ideal for offshore wind. But what did we look at? We looked at the fishing activity, the different types of fishing that occurred there, the intensity of it. We looked at the economic value. We looked at marine transportation. We looked at recreational activities in the area that were not related to fishing, such as scuba diving and sailing. We also looked at archaeological resources. It was a pretty thorough look at really the State Waters Project and the waters adjacent to it.
Kevin Stokesbury, you've thought a lot about the impact of wind farms on marine life, especially sea scallops. What locations are better to be off limits than others when we're thinking about putting them in the water?
I was involved in some of that earlier work as well for the Massachusetts place, and it was similar to what Dave was saying. The Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management selected a grid pattern off of Nantucket, and then they did come to New Bedford. There's a New Bedford Fisheries Advisory Panel that I'm on, and we looked at the different fisheries that were going on there, including scallops, and helped them focus that area down. They cut it down by about half at the first start. This industry is really, caught wildfire, and it's going very quickly, and it's going up and down the coast. And so some of the other places where they're being developed, there is a lot of overlap. In the Mid-Atlantic, some of the developments there are directly on top of scallop grounds, and they're certainly affecting the mackerel. And then the Massachusetts area, New Bedford doesn't have a big squid fishery, but you do here in Rhode Island, and I don't know that industry was really consulted as much on certainly the Massachusetts area and such. So there's a lot of conflict with it.
Ed LeBlanc, how do you balance the concerns of protecting marine life with where the turbines need to be to get the most energy?
So we have the areas that have been defined by BOEM to place the wind farms. But I can tell you that we are as concerned about the effects to the environment as anyone. And I think if you look at what the fishing industry and the other waterway users are concerned about, those are exactly the same concerns Ørsted has. I think if you matched them up, you'd find a lot of agreement between our concerns. We want to be good neighbors. We're all for coexistence, and I firmly believe that we can coexist quite beneficially and mutually beneficial coexistence in wind farm areas. We are definitely not in the business of putting others out of business. It's just not a sustainable model, and Ørsted is all about sustainment. So, we have those same concerns, and I think if you look at our record and you look at the actions that we're taking to examine these issues, proves our concern.
So let's move from location to configuration. So it's not just where these wind farms are, but it's how far apart each turbine is. So Lanny, talk a little bit about your concerns about where these should be, how close together or how spread apart they should be.
My concerns have to do with the density of these turbines. We don't have a choice. BOEM leased these areas out, and they have dictated, and the Coast Guard recently has dictated where each one of these turbines are going to go. The fish industry doesn't have a choice in the matter. I mean, in fact, that was that document came out today.
But talk a little bit about, you know, what your concerns are about where they're placed, what your ideal configuration might be.
Well, if you look over in Europe, the largest wind farm today that exists today is 55 square miles. Here in this country, we're going to start out with 1,400 square miles. It's a huge difference. They have them isolated in low-value fishing grounds in Europe. That's how it took off in Europe. Here, we're going to the heart of our fishing industry. There's one reason why this area was chosen. The biggest reason that these areas were chosen is so that the landowner couldn't complain from their waterfront mansions on Ocean Drive or down in Westerly. That's where they are. They're out of sight of land. If you went out for a two-mile boat ride, you're going to see them. But from the shoreline, you're not going to see them. And they are some of the most valuable fishing grounds that the Rhode Island industry and the Massachusetts industry has. And all we were asking is not to become collateral damage. That's all we've ever asked from the beginning. Like I said, I've been involved in this since 2008. And if it's done right, we have that possibility. But if we're in a rush to get these things in the water, then we're going to have big problems. There is no reason for us to rush this through. We can do this in the right fashion and get this right so there can be coexistence. One nautical mile spacing with no shipping lanes.
I'm just going to have Ed. Disaster. I'm just going to have Ed have a chance to respond to some of the things you said, Lanny.
Sure. So, you know, you've heard terms tonight like a stampede and wildfire. And again, we want the same thing. We being Orsted and generally the wind industry wants the same thing that Lanny just talked about. We don't want it to be collateral damage either. That's not being a good neighbor. That's not coexistence. Let's just try to put things in perspective, okay? Like, we're not talking about filling 1,400 square miles with wind towers. That might happen in 25 or 30 years if things go well. We have 5 towers owned and operated by Orsted right now in the U.S. The entire country, 5 towers. The next project by Orsted will be probably 15 towers. And then after that, another project might be around 50 towers. And we're talking years now down the road. So, first of all, we have about 24 wind farms around the globe that we operate. Not a single example of anyone definitely going out of business. Because any industry going out of business because of the wind farms. Probably just the opposite if you look at it. And we have those wind farms over a 20-year period of experience. And then lastly, the application process in the U.S. to get from initial application to eventual operating is a minimum of 8 years. So there's no rush there.
Kevin Stokesbury, you wanted to respond.
Yeah, a bit to address your question. So at a recent presentation in Boston by BOEM, they said that the projected development with the energy proposed was 20,000 megawatts up and down the coast. And right now there's a 10 megawatt turbine. So that's 2,000 turbines. And in these different areas, you're going to have them on a one nautical mile grid. Now, what Lenny and the other fishermen that I've talked to are talking about is that there are a number of fisheries that tow gear, both recreational and commercial, things like the recreational tuna fishery, the scallop fishery, the ground fishery. Those vessels, even, you know, they might be 30 meters long, but they're towing gear behind them. They're not going to be able to turn or fish safely within those kind of grids. And even transiting, because they all have stabilizers, so it expands the width of the vessel quite a bit, and you're running through areas with 3 to 5 knot currents. You also get some fairly severe seas in there at certain times of the year. You generally, the boats that I've worked on when I do a wheel watch, if boats come within 3 nautical miles, you wake the captain up. And so now you're talking about boats transiting and trying to maneuver within one nautical mile with these turning blades. It's not clear how, to me anyway, it's not clear if the Coast Guard will be able to get in there and rescue someone if there's a helicopter situation. Most boats set their radar on a 6 nautical mile radius. That's 122 targets within that radar screen, and those are all blocked out if you have a squall. So, you know, the fishermen, in this sense, one of the frustrating things about this debate that I find is that fishermen are professionals. When I go out there, I don't argue with the captain about how to fish their gear. That's their job. And so if they say they need a 4 mile transit, well, then they need a 4 mile transit. That's what they're talking about.
So that brings up a most recent report that was conducted by the U.S. Coast Guard. Ed LeBlanc, you worked for the Coast Guard before you joined Orsted. I wonder if you could just briefly summarize what this report had to say about the spacing of these wind farms, how much space should be allowed for ships to travel through or around.
Sure. So the report that you're referring to, Megan, is called the MARPARS report, the Massachusetts Rhode Island Port Access Route Study, and it's been long awaited. Began last March, and it was published in a draft form yesterday. And the Coast Guard found, and the study area, by the way, was this wind energy area south of Martha's Vineyard, and the Coast Guard found that in a uniform layout with three lines of orientation, you know, north, south, east, west, and then northeast, southwest, things like that. Three lines of orientation and minimum spacing of between 0.6 and 0.8 miles between towers, that would provide for sufficient room for safe navigation, and it would provide for the Coast Guard ability to conduct search and rescue within the wind farm. Provided, of course, that mariners take extra precaution when entering a wind farm and have a proper watch on their vessels and so forth.
So Lanny, you've navigated those waters. What do you think of those recommendations?
I think it's absolutely absurd. We've got these fishermen in this room that have been fishing their whole lives who are very heavily involved in safety drills, and I can tell you that is absurd. I can tell you that there's going to be people that, you know, my projection was what is going to happen is we're going to have accidents, people are going to die, we're going to lose vessels, and if the government doesn't step in and stop people from entering these areas, the insurance companies will. We've already had it happen. There's a place called Quix's Hole where accidents started happening. The insurance company said, well, you're on your own. You go in there, we don't insure you anymore. If you've ever been out in a gale of wind, okay, when it's blowing 30 or 40 knots and it's snowing or raining and seeing what your radar looks like, you're not going through that wind farm. What you're going to have is that the whole fleet is going to avoid that area in foul weather. It's fine on a bluebird, beautiful summer day. That's not when we're fishing. We're out there year-round. A lot of times this time of year, like right now, this guy's leaving right now to go offshore to get this weather window in before the next storm rolls in. Everybody's going to be coming home at the same time, coming home on a southeast wind or whatever, trying to get in before the storm hits. Everybody's going to congregate to get around that area, not go through it. That's going to make intense traffic all in one area, and we're going to have accidents. There's no doubt in my mind. I do not think that report that just came out is what's going to end. We're going to end up with out there. I hope not. We need to have transit lanes in order to have some safety, and even then we're going to have accidents.
Dave Butel, what do you think? Do you think those recommendations are realistic, or they need to change for safety?
Well, the Coastal Resources Management Council has worked with the fishing industry, and while we will defer to what the Coast Guard opinion is, what we have advocated for is a 1 nautical mile grid in every direction between the turbines. So that is what our agency has advocated for with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management.
The industry is committed to a minimum of 1 nautical mile spacing and a uniform grid layout throughout the entire wind energy area south of Martha's Vineyard.
So Ed, you're saying that your company is committed to working with the fishermen to make sure that there are these transit lanes?
On many levels, we are committed to working with the fishing industry. We have devoted staff, money, scientific support. We are definitely committed to working with all the waterway users that we would share that area with.
All right, let's transition quickly to thinking about these wind farms once they're actually in the ocean. Let's say we found a perfect spot where there's enough room for the boats to get around in an imaginary world. Now they're in the water. Dave Butel, what would you say are sort of the top concerns about these wind farms as they're operating?
So once they were installed, the concerns were, number one is, to date, we haven't had a fishing industry work within a wind farm. So that would be some kind of learning curve that would need to occur. Even at a one nautical mile grid spacing, the fishing industry would need to modify the way they conduct their activities. The other part is actually involves construction a little bit, but what's going to happen to the fish species that are within the wind farm? Will the construction noise drive them away permanently? And I say that because some of the species are short-lived, and meaning that their entire lifespan is shorter than the construction window. So that would be a potential serious effect. There are a couple more. The operational noise of the wind farm, currently in the U.S., we don't have that. The other one is the potential for a negative impact from electromagnetic fields from the undersea cables that bring the power to shore. That hasn't been documented that it is a negative, but it has a significant potential to be negative. It also has a potential that it could be positive for certain fish, but those are the issues.
All right, we're going to pick up and talk a little more about those concerns, but first we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Divided Waters, a community discussion about how offshore wind and fishing might coexist in the age of climate change. We'll be right back. You're listening to Divided Waters. I'm Megan Hall. Before the break, we were talking about concerns related to wind farms once they start operating. Ed LeBlanc, I'm going to actually bring up a listener question now. This came from listener Richard Catskill. He wants to know, what does the long-term data show concerning the impact on sea life and fishing for major wind farms built in other similar locations around the world? I know Ørsted has these larger projects in other parts of the world. What are you learning about the effects?
Well, keep in mind that I'm relatively new to Ørsted, so I'll caveat my answer with that. But again, we have 20 years of experience behind us, and I think we're proud of that record on how we've coexisted quite productively in Europe. I don't know the specifics of impacts. I can speak to the what I see anyway with the Block Island wind farm in terms of recreational fishing and excursion vessels and commercial fishing still being seen out there. I think that's a success story. And again, I think going forward, you know, we're not looking to build out 1,400 square miles overnight. It's a very long process we're talking about, a very methodical process, a very well-researched process.
Lanny Dellinger, you're shaking your head.
I learned an awful lot early on in this. And like I say, going back to 2008, it was one of the good things that the Ocean Sam provided is where they brought an awful lot of scientists over from Europe that I get to meet. Fellow by the name of Dr. Andrew Grill, for one. And the first thing that he told us, this is back in 2008, do not do what we did in Europe. Make sure you conduct your baseline studies. And here we are. We did the exact same thing they did in Europe. We're doing it the wrong way. They have no way to gauge the impacts. I've had direct conversations with a fellow by the name of Phil McMullen, who is was the head of sea fish over in Europe. And if you want to know, talk to fishermen who have been to Europe and talk to those fishermen. We've met them. We've talked to them. They've been brought over here to educate us, to let us know, to warn us, you know, to try to give us a little insight of what we're faced with. There's a lot you can learn, but you have to listen. And we're not listening. We need to do this the right way. And so far, we're not.
Dave Utell, you've done a lot of research on this topic. What do you know about what's happened in other parts of the world?
I would agree with Lanny's assessment of what has happened in other parts of the world. The studies that would be valuable for us to know the results from have not been conducted in Europe.
So it sounds like you're saying there's still a lot of unknowns.
Very clearly, there are many unknowns.
Kevin Stokesbury, can you provide any sort of context? If you could compare apples to apples, the UK versus the New England area, in terms of stock or impact, any sort of perspective on what's happening there and what might happen here?
Sure. My understanding of the in Europe is similar to what you've heard. They did not do before-after control impact studies or before-after gradient studies. There weren't that many surveys going out before then, and the fisheries, particularly in the North Sea, were fairly depleted. And so the fishing industry, I mean, there's still krill fisheries and that type of thing, but it's not really the same scale as what we're working on here. And you know, there are some of the industries here are the wind farm industries are investing in before after surveys. I think that one of the main concerns is that the timeline isn't very long. You know, the construction is going to happen pretty quickly. I mean, we're at SMAS, we're working with Vineyard Wind on ventless trap surveys and trawl surveys and drop camera surveys. There's also a number of different those going on, but I'll speak to it more at the end. But I'm a little concerned that there isn't as big a scientific framework as there should be. But having this was brought up at the Academy of Science. They had some of these experts like Andrew over, and they said just that they had not completed the before studies, and they really recommended that we get the baselines in. Now NEPA we do have good data for our continental shelf, mostly based on stock assessments, but these wind farms are going to be in a fairly small area compared to when the Marine Fisheries Service surveys the whole stock. They're looking at the whole mid-Atlantic, and so the number of samples within those particular areas and just adjacent to it is probably not enough for statistical comparison, which is why you need to have these companies and other or other resources step up and survey it on a much more intense level.
We're going to close out this part of the discussion in just a few minutes, but first to bring up a different perspective. We've been talking about all the concerns and worries about the impact of wind farms on fisheries, but we also got a question from listener Captain Dave Monty, and he says, I'm a charter captain. I've fished the Block Island wind farms. In his opinion, he says, it has no adverse effects on fisher habitat, possibly a positive impact. He wants to know, why aren't we talking about the positives? Does anyone want to react to that?
I surely would. I'm very familiar with the Block Island wind farm area. I can tell you that the entire ecology changed there. Okay, and it's proven. URI has the videos. They went out there and videoed before, during, and after. It's completely different. When you start playing around with Mother Nature and changing habitats, squid, for instance, need a certain type of habitat. Well, when you turn that habitat into rocky, cobbly bottom and animals like black sea bass, and I'm sure that's what Dave likes to go over. It's real easy. There's so many sea bass over there. It's like going to the golf course pond and catching the sunfish when you were a kid because they've congregated around it. So it's made an artificial reef of sorts. But it doesn't affect all species. It doesn't appear. We don't have the science to prove that. But sea bass have inundated that place. Every animal in the ocean has its own particular habitat, just like on land. You know, you find different critters in different places for a reason. It's the same thing out on the ocean. And when you change that habitat, you're going to change the animals that are going to be found there.
We have just a few seconds, but Ed, I want to give you a chance to respond.
So we have a different view. When you talk about 20 years of pounding, well, let's talk about that a little bit. So the towers are erected in very narrow seasons for construction. And at least at Orsted, we go to great lengths, and we did at the Block Island Wind Farm. You know, we have acoustics in the water to measure sound. We have marine mammal observers on the surface. You know, again, we go to great measures to protect the environment while we are meeting the public policy goals of renewable energy. And there's a balance that we need to maintain here. And, you know, I hear that there's no science, but we have two scientists on the panel that, three scientists that devote their lives to it. Then we talk about scientists coming to visit us from Europe. Science is being done everywhere. So I believe that we can, again, coexist where we can look at the science needs and look at the potential impacts to the environment while we proceed with building renewable energy. The cost for inaction, I think, is equal to or greater than certainly the cost of building renewable energy.
That's actually a great segue into the next segment of our conversation. You're listening to Divided Waters. I'm Megan Hall. So one of the main arguments for offshore wind is that it creates energy without the carbon dioxide emissions that are warming the atmosphere. And those emissions are also increasing the temperature of Rhode Island's waters. So what's worse for fishing, wind farms or climate change? Or is the choice that simple? So for some perspective, I'm bringing in Becca Selden. She's an assistant professor of aquatic ecology at Wellesley College. So Becca, what does your research say about how fish are reacting to these changes in the water?
Our area here on the Northeast is one of the most rapidly warming areas in the globe, and we are already seeing dramatic shifts in where we're finding species, particularly lobster. Lobsters shifted quite north, hundreds of miles over the time frame that we have our survey. And so fisheries truly are on the front lines of these climate impacts. It's not climate impacts by 2100 in some other country. It's now and here on our coast, and it's definitely impacting livelihoods. So I think with the long view, I think providing a more carbon neutral energy framework is something that has the potential for a win-win for the fishing industry as well as for the renewable energy industry. I think the Point Judith is one of the communities that I've been working on in our research, thinking about how communities adapt to shifting distributions. Squid is obviously a big fishery there, and we've seen not only poleward shifts having effects on fishing communities, but also sort of offshore effects as well, so moving further away from port. And so I think our region is this sort of this front line, this place that we really need to be thinking about climate change effects on fisheries as we think with maybe a longer time horizon.
So, Lanny Dellinger, you've been fishing for 40 years. Are you seeing these changes in the water? Is it affecting your catch?
Yeah, there's no doubt that climate change does have effects on different species, and it changes almost from year to year. I mean, we've seen cold years, even in the last 15 or 20 years, where you'll see certain species in more abundance than others. Climate change, I mean, I think everybody realizes the climate's changing, okay? But that being said, when the ocean stamp started back in 2008, I bet you some of that documentation still exists, that we wouldn't be seeing any codfish today. Guess what? We've got a whole bunch of codfish around here this year. So it's not quite that simple. It's a very, very complicated issue, and it's very dynamic out in the oceans. I have, I don't know, 6 or 7 years of water temperature data from out in the Sound, from doing lobster trap ventless surveys for the Block Island project in one of the control areas. I can tell you, we never saw the bottom temperatures exceed what's considered to be stressful to lobsters. We never saw it exceed the 67 or 68 degrees bottom temperatures. So there's a lot to it, and there's a lot we do not know.
Becca Selden, can you talk about what we do know? What are you seeing as the future for the kind of fish that are even available in this area?
Yeah, I think we have to think about some of our own experience over the last 30 years in terms of what changes we've seen and what we're expecting for the future. The Gulf of Maine in particular is likely to warm dramatically over the near term. And right now, we have seen a boom in the lobster populations in the Gulf of Maine. But declines in southern New England lobster. Some of those collapses in those populations might be due to a shell disease, which may itself be fueled by warming waters. I, as a scientist, am concerned about the potential sustainability of the lobster fishery moving into the future if we start exceeding some of these temperatures that Lainey was mentioning as we sort of move further and further into the future. I think lobster fishery is one that we want to be keeping an eye on.
Can you talk a little bit about ocean acidification and how that might also affect the kind of marine life in our waters?
Yeah, so ocean acidification is sort of the other CO2 problem, where CO2 in the atmosphere gets absorbed by the ocean, and that makes our waters more acidic. And that's really problematic for shellfish and other things that need that calcium to make their shells. And so shellfish industries around the country are struggling with how to deal with this moving forward. And I think that's definitely part of the vision that we need to think about in terms of how do we manage our fisheries for both warming temperatures and more acidified waters.
What are some ways that you recommend that fishermen like Lainey might have to readjust the way they fish, given these realities?
Well, I think he's already doing a great job of contributing to that science with those data loggers on having bottom temperature on his traps. I know a lot of fishermen in Maine are doing the same, and I think that is actually going to give us that high-resolution temperature data that we need to sort of have a early warning signal of when we're going to have a really warm year. I think other than that, I think I know other fishermen, say, out of Point Pleasant, or other, say, Montauk fishermen who fish lobster have actually shifted towards Jonah crab, which is not as lucrative as lobster, but it seems like there's a lot of adaptability that are inherent in many of the fishing practices. Mm-hmm. I think we as consumers can help by buying local and sort of buying sort of whatever the fishermen are bringing us. That's one way that consumers can get involved in helping fishermen be adapting to these changes.
Dave Butel, you've looked at a lot of this data too. How do you sort of weigh the challenges of wind farms with the realities of climate change?
Well, as everyone else has said, this is very complicated. It's a constant or a continuous question that we at our agency debate, which one is really leading the impacts on fisheries. So, and we don't have a clear answer. But I would like to clarify something that's been people have been talking about here, that there isn't science going on. There is a lot of science going on, whether it's the right science or whether it's sufficient to address all of the questions, that remains. But there is plenty of research work that is occurring.
Thank you for that clarification. Becca Selden, I don't know if this is your area of expertise, but I'm just going to throw it out there. There are all these concerns about climate change. Do we need offshore wind to address climate change here in New England, or could we get renewable energy some other way? Is this something that we're going to have to figure out how to do if we want to get to a point where we're not emitting all of these carbon dioxide emissions?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert in sort of the energy portfolio that would be ideal here, but I do agree that it is likely part of that portfolio. And I think the wind is here, as was said earlier, and so taking advantage of the renewable sources that we have, I think, is a smart solution. But I also agree with Lainey and others that placing and the siting of these sites has to be strategic and smart as well. And I think there has been research done by a colleague of mine that actually looked at when you quantitatively incorporate the trade-offs between fisheries, say, whale watching tourism, and sort of the ideal wind energy potential, you can actually design a win-win solution that actually avoids losses to the fishing industry and actually allows the wind farms to be bigger, that gives gains to the energy sector. So I think the science suggests that this can be done in a smart way that quantitatively uses the data about how to put them in a place that makes sense.
That is a great segue to the next segment of our conversation, which is moving towards solutions. So very complicated, lots of concerns, but how do we move forward together? But first, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Divided Waters. You're listening to Divided Waters. I'm Megan Hall. We've spent the past hour talking about all of the concerns and challenges around placing wind farms in the ocean, how they might coexist with fisheries. So let's turn towards some ideas for what we do next. We don't have a lot of time, but I'm going to have everyone on the panel give their proposal for if you were in charge, if you could, you know, wave a magic wand and create a system where both of these industries could exist, how would you do it? I'm going to start with Dave Butel.
That's an interesting question. I wish I did have a magic wand to wave, but really to move forward successfully for the industries to coexist, once the turbines are installed, the fishing industry and the wind energy need to communicate directly with one another clearly and in ways in which each of them understand each other. One of the big topics that I think needs to be addressed in that communication is creating a plan for the mitigation during construction, because it's pretty clear to many of us that the fishing industry will be very much compromised in the construction process. But all of that is from communications between the fishing industry and the wind energy industry.
Thank you. Lanny Dellinger, what's your vision for the future?
If I was in command control, I would put the brakes on, and if I could turn back the clock a little bit, I would have been collecting baseline data for the last 5 or 6 years so that we could do this in a manner that's not going to be destructive to our oceans and our ecosystem. Why create another problem trying to fix the problem that we're trying to address with climate change? It doesn't make any sense. People don't realize, like for my fishery, I'm an Area 2 lobster fisherman. I am bound by a permit where I can go in the ocean. And that so happens that this 1,400 square miles is the piece of the ocean where I can go. So once the construction starts for the next who knows how many years, that's going to displace a lot of people. It's how I made my living for my whole life. I got children, kids that I put through college. I'm 56 years old. Where am I going? You put me out of business, and that's it. I mean, that's my livelihood. That's what I've done my whole life. I love that ocean. You know, I mean, everybody thinks, you know, you hear a lot of stuff about fishermen. The fishermen that are left today, we love that ocean. We care about it. We were recently up at the State House, I think yesterday, for a ban on balloons. Well, that started with the fishing industry because we're so tired of being out on the ocean and chasing down balloons floating around from people letting them go for graduation parties or weddings. I get it. But Lanny, it's senseless.
Lanny, I'm just going to have to cut you off because we're running out of time. But I'm going to move on to Ed LeBlanc. Thank you for your perspective.
So I think we need to look at where we agree on things, and I think we agree on a lot more than might be evident. The fisherman said he didn't know enough about offshore wind and the science related to it. And we think there's plenty known, but we also would agree that there's plenty that we need to know, and we've taken actions in that regard. The fisherman wants a robust scientific record, a good understanding of impacts and mitigations, good planning. We want all of those too. You know, so we're in violent agreement on many of these issues. The fishermen are concerned about being displaced from fishing grounds. We don't want to displace anybody from fishing grounds. They're concerned about navigation safety. So are we. And we've adjusted our layouts, and we've taken a lot of positive action to address those issues. The radar impacts, we're looking at that. We're doing pre- and post-construction radar surveys. And fishermen's concerned about wind farms messing with their livelihoods. We don't want to mess with anybody's livelihoods, but I think climate change is messing with livelihoods, and so we need to take some action.
Thank you, Ed. Becca Selden, what's your vision for the future?
Yeah, I think if these really specific details about spacing can be figured out, I think there's huge potential for there to be coexistence between wind and fisheries. And I think it's important to recognize that fisheries is not a monolithic thing. There's going to be very different impacts for fixed gear fisheries, like for traps, lobster, and crab, than there would be for trawl. Obviously, trawl is going to be almost certainly excluded from these areas, but you know, the trap fisheries maybe could be deployed if you can figure out these safe transit lanes or things that seem like there could be some negotiation possibility. And if you do, I think there are, you know, there's evidence from Europe that sometimes, you know, for many species, there's more habitat, rocky habitat sort of added, or I guess hard habitat added, than there is soft bottom habitat taken away. So it could be a net positive, could. But I think I agree with Lainey that I think a key is to get the scientific research going. And I think the fact that there are such committed fishermen who are already doing data collection could be leveraged formally, perhaps a funding mechanism from the industry to actually fund some of this, get that baseline data with the fishing industry collaboration. And I think that is really important to be able to not just assume that there will be impacts, positive or negative, but to actually get the scientific data. And for the from the perspective of climate change, I think we really should learn from the lessons of the extreme warming events we've seen on the West Coast, the Pacific warm blob that actually led to fisheries disasters totaling in the amount of $70 million over a three-year time period. So I think that's a window to the future that really should give us some urgency in trying to figure this out, that we don't want that to happen here.
Kevin Stokesbury, how do we move forward?
I would suggest building a scientific framework. And what that framework would entail would be the four pillars of sustainability, which are the ecology, economics, community, and the agencies. And I would compare the wind farm to the fisheries, and I look at it at three different scales: the scale of the turbine, the scale of the farm, the particular wind farm, and the scale of the entire region. And then overlay that on the potential impacts to the different ocean environment, which is the sediment, the substrat, the water column, the acoustic environment, and the electromagnetic environment. So I would build a structure like that that would allow you to compare and contrast the two and start to fill in the areas where we have holes, because we do have some scientific information on some of those scales, but we don't have information on all of them. And I think that would give us a better means to weigh the pros and cons and to move forward in a logical fashion.
I want to thank you all for your thoughtful answers to this really complicated question. So we spent over an hour talking to these great experts on our panels about fisheries and wind farms and how they might coexist. But there are more experts and perspectives in the audience, and now we want to hear from you. I want to start over here. Please introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Paul Rosselli with the Burleville Land Trust. For the last 4 years, I and many others in the state, and maybe even some people in the room, have been fighting and have fought a frack gas-fired power plant proposed for the middle of the woods in the northwest corner of Rhode Island. And one of the reasons we fought it was because whatever came out of those smokestacks way up in the northwest corner of Rhode Island was going to end up in the bay. One of the reasons that it was defeated was because of you folks here today. You helped defeat that, because somewhere in these last 14 years, you've decided that you're going to try to make an effort. You're going to make an effort to talk to one another, to get in line with one another, to figure this out, and put some of our energy needs somewhere that would be the least destructive and the most environmentally safe. And that appears to be someplace offshore. My question, and part comment in my question, is why haven't you worked it out to date yet?
It's complicated.
Yeah.
Besides being complicated, a lot of it has been taken out of our hands. I mean, Rhode Island did a wonderful job. Our federal government has not, because they didn't take a lot of these things that we've been discussing, was not taken in by them. A lot of folks went to bat to try to do the best job we could. And even though we have this wonderful document, we did this great job in Rhode Island, well, guess what? All of these projects are in federal waters where we don't have much say. It wasn't done right, and it wasn't because of the state of Rhode Island. It was because of our federal government.
Yeah, do you want to weigh in, no. Ed?
Well, I have a different view. You know, I think there were many adjustments made to the lease areas, and I'm not speaking for BOEM or on behalf of BOEM or anyone else, just what I've seen and what I think I know. In my view, the stakeholders were listened to, and not every stakeholder got what every stakeholder wanted, but the initial lease areas were huge, and then they were reduced based on input from people. And there's various factors that have to be weighed in different weight attached to each of those factors, and it is very, very complicated.
Let's hear from our next audience member.
Yes, my name is Fred Matera. Excuse me, a commercial fisherman for 40 years, retired out of Point Judith. I'm also executive director of the Commercial Fisheries Center and the president of the Commercial Fisheries Research Foundation. Some of these questions that have been posed today, and believe me, this is a healthy dialogue, and thank you so much for bringing, you know, it looks like we got 150 people or more. This is amazing. I, as a fisherman, I understand that we need to reduce our carbon footprint. I have children and I have grandchildren, and we need to make that change, and we need to coexist, but we need to do it in the right fashion, and we do need to slow this down. So we need to continue to have this open dialogue back and forth and find answers. When you say, oh, I don't know where they all are, well, I'll tell you, there will be hundreds of turbines. I can't fathom, as a fisherman for 40 years going out to sea, it's daunting to me. You know, Kevin made a point. On a six-mile radar, it's 125 targets that are there. That's just in a benign situation. I have an 85-foot fishing vessel. When I go to sea, I go hundreds of miles away from the port of Point Judith. And I don't come home until the weather gets nasty. And I mean real nasty. So my concern is this lack of irresponsible from the Coast Guard on this study of allowing just one nautical mile as a transit lane through hundreds of turbines. I'm going to tell you, we will lose vessels and we will lose lives. I now have to steam anywhere from 45 to 90 miles through that. And then there's going to be a channel of vessels trying to get through there. And if I lose propulsion or anything like that, I'm going to be on top of a turbine. So in that respect, I think we need to do better, and I hope the dialogue will continue.
We'll go with the next audience member.
Hi, my name's Captain Dave Monty. Thanks for mentioning my question. Thank you, panelists. All of you are very sincere in what you do, and I appreciate you being here tonight. But I'm a charter captain and fishing guide. I fish in the Block Island Wind Farm area in Narragansett Bay off Newport. And I have to say that the complexion of fish that I catch in whole is vastly different. The type of fish and the abundance of fish due to climate change. The American lobster no longer in our area. The winter flounder, cod, those are cold water fish. Those have gone. And we've been experiencing an influx of warm water fish like black sea bass, summer flounder to a certain extent. Climate change is definitely having an impact on my industry. And I know in the Block Island wind farm area, the wind turbines, basically 90 feet of structure. There's huge muscle growth on it. It's attracting fish. It has easily 300% more fishing pressure than it ever had before because now it's a destination. And because of that, arguably, the fishing is even better in spite of this 300 to 400% increase in fishing pressure. So I'm here to say that the wind farms, as far as recreational fishing is going, have been a positive effect. I fish the wind farm area next to commercial fishermen who are rod and reeling. There's fixed gear in place right next to the wind farm, and there are trawlers that trawl right along the wind farm as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
So my name is Stephen Porter, and full disclosure, I'm part of the Possibly team, but I'm also a global change scientist at Brown. There's nothing slow about climate change, and it is true that the climate will continue to change even if we convert to 100% renewable energy right now, but it will change much more, much quicker, and much more painfully for all of us if we don't rapidly transition to renewables. A question was asked whether wind and offshore wind is sort of the best for Rhode Island's portfolio. As I can unequivocally say that we need offshore wind to power our society. There isn't another viable choice in Rhode Island. So I just wanted to say that and to make a plug for the idea that climate change and the rapidity of it is not going to be fun. And that, yes, fisheries, we need to understand how to do this well, but more baseline data for decades before we start putting in windmills will lead to a climate catastrophe that no one here or anywhere wants. And we need to move quickly.
Hi, my name's Tara Panisi. I just wanted to ask a quick question. I read a book called Cod a few years ago that compared the fishing industries of the United States and Canada. And what they found was when they had put restrictions on areas where you were not able to fish, where they did not do that in the United States, so Canada had put certain restrictions, they actually found that their fishing industry rebounded from their cod species in Canada and did not in the United States. Is it possible, and has there been any thought put to the possibility that in areas that we are unable to fish, it might be better for the species of fish to have an area of sanctuary so that we will always have sustainable fishing?
So that fairly quickly, I think. I mean, right now with the New England Fisheries Management Council, there is a habitat plan, and there are areas that are closed permanently to fishing just for that purpose, like the HAPC up on the northern edge of the Gulf of Maine, and there's a number on Georgia's Bank, and there's a number in the Gulf of Maine as well. So that in a number of our different management plans, rotational management and closed areas, either seasonally or in some cases permanently, is being used. I think with this, and there's definitely the possibility, as Dave and some others have pointed out, that these wind farms will act as a closed area and some species will benefit. But it'll also change the habitat that's out there now. And so there will be winners and losers. That's just the nature of it.
My name is Isha Chavla, and I'm studying sustainability at Brown. So I know that wind energy is something that's really important in our transition away from fossil fuels. And it is really urgent that we do transition away from fossil fuels. But Lainey, I empathize with a lot of the things that you said today. And I guess my question is that if wind energy has to come to Rhode Island, which it must in our transition away from fossil fuels, you said this isn't the right way to do things. So what actionably would you say is the right way to do things?
You need to slow it down and get science that is going to tell us that what we're doing is not going to cause major harm to our oceans and the habitat and the environment out there.
I'm just going to ask Becca to weigh in. Do we have the time to wait for the science to be right for wind farms?
Well, I agree that I think the time for action is now. And if there is this staged process of building turbines slowly, I think you can in some ways treat it as that before or after control impact experiment if you design your monitoring to do it in that way. And I think you can think about this in the framework of something called adaptive management, where you actually assess, did that work or not? What were the impacts? And have that be a process. I know with stakeholder-driven processes, it takes a long time to sort of shift the boat if needed, but I think that can be done. And I think that we do need to start moving towards this direction.
You've been listening to Divided Waters, a live event brought to you by the Institute at Brown for Environment and Society, possibly, and the Publix Radio. Tonight's event was recorded by Tom Van Buskirk and edited by James Baumgartner. Aaron Reed provided technical support, editorial oversight by Sally Isley, Stephen Porter, and Nadine Sabai. Possibly's theme song is by Tom Van Buskirk. And I'm your host, Megan Hall. Thank you, and good night.
Public service journalism for Rhode Island and southeastern Massachusetts. This is the Publix Radio, 89.3 FM and HD WNPN Newport, 102.7 FM and HD WNPE Narragansett Pier, 91.5 FM WCVY Coventry Public Schools, 88.1 FM WELH The Wheeler School Providence, thepublixradio.org, and on smart speakers and devices everywhere.